Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to my debrief episode for my dialogue with Tim Gordon on the issue of feminism. For those of you who are new to the podcast, know that when I have guests on and we have discussions about points where we disagree, I normally do a debrief episode to go over the conversation, talk about how I think it went, and then talk about some points that might have been lost in the shuffle to provide clarity for everyone who is listening. So what did I think of this conversation with Tim? Well, I think that this clip from the 2004 film Anchorman really summarizes how I think the conversation went.
Boy, that escalated quickly. I mean, that really got out of hand fast.
It jumped up a notch.
It did, didn't it?
Yeah, I stabbed a man in the heart.
I saw that. Brick killed a guy. Did you throw a trident?
Yeah, there were horses and a man on fire, and I killed a guy with a trident.
Brick, I've been meaning to talk to you about that. You should find yourself a safe house or a relative close by. Lay low for a while, because you're probably wanted for murder.
Now, I don't think that anybody threw a trident in anyone's chest or set anybody on fire, but it was definitely a contentious conversation, probably the most contentious one that I've had on the podcast ever. And that's unfortunate because that's not the kind of discussions that I want to have. I'm fine having discussions with people where we have strong disagreements, but I want them to be thoughtful discussions where people can get a lot out of them. And I don't think that's what we had in especially this conversation. I think the conversation on the death penalty actually went a lot better. But this one on feminism, we didn't get the quality discussion that I really wanted. And I think part of that was because Gordon came into this imagining we were going to have like a full-on debate. And I'm fine having debates. I've done over a dozen debates in my career as an apologist. But debates only work when you have a moderator and timed rounds. That way, each person has an equal opportunity to talk and challenge the other person's views. Otherwise, when you have the conversations like I have, where I am both the guest and the moderator, then I have to make judgment calls about when each of us is going to speak. And it can result in an unequal amount of speaking time. I mean, Tim spoke in the feminism dialogue, he spoke twice as long as I did. I think about for an hour and 7 minutes, and I only spoke for about 31 minutes. If I hadn't interrupted him in the conversation when I did, in a 90-minute conversation, I might have only spoke for about, I don't know, 10 or 15 minutes. And that doesn't lend itself to good dialogue. I mean, he asked me before the show, he said, do you want to do a friendly debate or a friendly discussion? And what I emailed back to him is I said, look, I'm thinking friendly disagreement. My dialogues haven't been super debate focused. I try to have good conversations with people while still asserting where I disagree with them. Here's a recent example. And then I shared the dialogue that I did with Brandon Robertson on whether homosexual behavior is a sin or not, which I think was a great example of a very fruitful dialogue with two people who disagree. And we didn't need a moderator there because we just had a really solid conversation. That's what I was going for in this discussion, but unfortunately, that's not what happened. Instead, the discussion kind of devolved into a combative debate, and so I felt like it generated more heat than light, and there were a lot of interruptions. It becomes very difficult to listen to, and I find that to be unfortunate. So I think in the future, I'm happy to have people on who may have very strong disagreements with me. But to prevent that from happening, I think in some cases I'm going to bring in a moderator to moderate the discussion, somebody like Cy Kellett or Chris Check or whomever. But I'm still looking forward to having people come on and we can have a very generous back and forth and we don't have to have that tense, you know, combative atmosphere. That's absolutely what I don't want to have on the podcast. And I'm planning not to have any more discussions on the podcast if they devolve into that. They can be a friendly conversation or they can be more of a moderated debate, but that's what I'm looking for. All right, now let's go through the subjects that were brought up, because like I said, the nature of the conversation, it kind of generated more heat than light. And so there's a lot of things we actually didn't get a chance to talk about that I would have really enjoyed talking about. For example, I think we reached an impasse on defining our terms. Whenever you have a conversation, you always have to be able to define your terms. Otherwise, you're talking past one another. And this is no exception. You have to define what feminism is. And there's a lot of different definitions that people offer. So if we're going to have a discussion, we have to get the definition right first. And so I offered a definition of feminism that was very simple, just we oppose sexism. And in fact, Pope St. John Paul II offers a very similar definition of that kind of feminism in his encyclical, The Gospel of Life. In Evangelium Vitae, paragraph 99, he says this. He says, in transforming culture so that it supports life, women occupy a place in thought and action which is unique and decisive. It depends on them to promote a new feminism, which rejects the temptation of imitating models of male domination, in order to acknowledge and affirm the true genius of women in every aspect of the life of society and overcome all discrimination, violence, and exploitation. So I think that if you define feminism, and I quoted a feminist who defines it that way, Bella Hooks. I mean, another one is, I think Marie Shears defines feminism as the radical view that women are people. If feminism is defined in that very basic way that you oppose sexism, I can't see anything morally problematic about it at all. And I don't think Tim would. So his counter to that, though, was that, well, no, that's not what feminism is at its core. Feminism is opposition to patriarchy, and Christianity supports patriarchy. So Christianity and feminism are contradictory. They can't go together. But here's the problem. We never defined what patriarchy was. We never got a chance to sit down and say, okay, well, what is patriarchy? Because you could say, well, feminism opposes patriarchy in the sense of it is against the unjust historical domination of women by men through things like denying them the right to vote, keeping them from having legal standing in a court of law when they marry their husbands. So if you define patriarchy as the unjust domination of men over women, then Christians can be feminists because we don't believe in unjust or evil domination of men over women. In fact, if you go back to scripture in Genesis 3:16, when we see what happens to Adam and Eve after the fall, so after the original sin has entered the world and human beings have sinned in the fall of man, the consequences of the fall include the fact that Adam will have to toil and engage in painful labor. He had to work in the garden, but it was not something that caused toil or unnecessary amounts of pain for him. And Eve would suffer pain in childbirth as a result of original sin. But it also says in Genesis 3:16 that as a result of original sin, your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. So this domination of men over women in this evil, controlling way, we see that's actually a consequence of original sin. And so Christians can't oppose patriarchy when it's defined in this way. Even when you go into the New Testament, in Galatians 3:28, St. Paul says there's neither Jew nor Greek, neither free nor slave, neither man and woman, that we are all equal in Christ. So if that is how you define feminism, in that equality in Christ between men and women, then there's no problem. If you define patriarchy as the idea that men are superior than women in the eyes of God. So that was a problem. We never got a chance to talk about what does Tim mean by patriarchy? What does feminism mean? So if we don't define the terms right, we're going to get out the gate in the wrong way. So when we discuss this, we have to say, look, there's different definitions of feminism. And then we have to say which definition has more merit to it and which has less. So I disagree with him when he said that feminism is monolithic. That is not the case at all in any social movement. Feminists are bitterly divided on certain questions. There are feminists who think that pornography and prostitution are evil and oppress women and ought to be illegal. And there are feminists who think prostitution and pornography are great things for women. There are feminists who think that a man who identifies as a woman, so a transgender woman, they say, yep, they're women. Those would be trans-inclusive radical feminists. The name is really a riff on another term that's more popular among feminists called TERFs, T-E-R-Fs. So these radicals are feminists who say that, well, you have to have a genetic code and anatomy. You know, there's being a woman, according to these radical feminists, is a biological question. And so they're called trans-exclusionary radical feminists because they say that a man who identifies as a woman is not a woman. And in fact, he's encroaching upon and oppressing women. So my point is, there are tons of divisions among feminists, even among, I mean, you have Catholics who identify as feminists. You have Feminists for Life that works to end abortion and argues for that from feminist principles. So it's just not monolithic. And because there's these different definitions, you have the opportunity to say, well, this definition is definitely not good. you know, the classic definition of feminism, that men and women are equal, but women are better. You know, well, no, we don't want to say that. We want to have true equality between men and women. So you can have a good definition that comes from that. So that's why I was just really surprised. I was really surprised in the conversation. And that's why I wanted to sit down with Tim, if he has this kind of overarching thesis that is so broad that I think that when you have really strident theses, arguments that don't admit for any kind of nuance, there's a high probability they're probably incorrect. So if you say something like, well, there's nothing good about feminism or that it's all evil, I know Tim might say, well, I didn't make that sweeping of a claim. But the problem was, in the conversation, I was just so surprised that he was not willing to grant that there were a lot of good things that feminists have accomplished. I think even among regular Catholics, you know, you hear feminism and you think of abortion, you think of contraception, you think of those radical activists who ran around topless and poured water on that bishop in Europe a few years ago. And yeah, that is evil, crazy stuff, no doubt. And then you'll say, well, the only good thing feminists did was they got women the right to vote. Though what was, I couldn't believe it, is that Tim couldn't just say, well, yeah, of course it's good that feminists secured the right to vote for women. He seemed really reluctant to want to be able to say that. But I would say that was a big gain in women having equality with men and having the right to vote. And to be anything less than very pleased with that, I just find that very odd. But also, I'll say to people listening who might think, oh, the only good thing feminists did were they got the right to vote, I brought up other examples in the conversation, and Tim just didn't really want to acknowledge them. And there's a lot of examples people don't think about. One was that I brought up was that married women did not have legal standing. They essentially disappeared. In fact, all the way up to the 1970s, my mom told me about this. My mom went to apply for a credit card, and she couldn't do that without my dad's permission. This was up into the 1970s. A married woman couldn't get a credit card, a checking account without her husband's permission. Now, you might say, well, maybe that's a good thing because, you know, a household, you know, it should be balanced and you shouldn't have people plunging the house into debt without the other person knowing. And there's an argument for that. But the sexism involved in that is that men are allowed to go and open checking accounts and get credit cards and get debt without their wives' permission, but not the other way around. So that's sexist and that's wrong. If you want to say, look, when you're married, both the husband and wife have to agree to new accounts and things like that, that's treating it equally. It may not be pragmatic or prudent, but at least you'd be treating the man and woman in this case as being equals. But aside from that, there's a whole host of other things people don't give feminism credit for, that it's done a lot of good. I'll give you some very basic examples. One would be ending the law of chastisement. These are examples I wish we could have talked about more in the conversation, but we kind of moved away from feminism and got into the discussion about whether mothers should work pretty quickly, which was hard because I really wanted to talk a lot about feminism because it has a fascinating history behind it. I know it's a word, it's a really loaded word. I don't like using the word feminist because it has so many negative connotations to it, but we've really forgotten, like, women faced a ton of sexist discrimination, and it's crazy when you go back through the history. I'll give you some examples. One is the law of chastisement. So I give this example for abortion because people will say, you know, my body, my choice. I can do what I want with my body, even kill this baby inside of me. And we say, well, that's barbaric. Well, in the 19th century, there was a North Carolina district court case. It was North Carolina versus Jesse Black. And the question was, can Jesse Black beat his wife? That was literally the question in front of the court. And they said he can as long as he doesn't leave a mark. That was based on the law of chastisement. They said the court basically ruled his home, his marriage, his rights. My marriage, my home, my choice is what the court said. And so now we would say, obviously, that a woman should not practice tyranny over her unborn child. Even if they admit the unborn child is a human being, we would say, if you say it's a human being and that abortion is still okay, then you are mirroring the tyranny that men once had over women, that they could beat their wives. Now, I think it's an urban legend. You probably heard of the rule of thumb, that a man couldn't beat his wife with a stick wider than his thumb. I think that's actually an urban legend. But the law of chastisement was very real. Men could beat their wives and hit them to discipline them because that was the rule of a husband. A woman certainly could not do that to her husband. Now, he couldn't break her arm or he couldn't leave like a permanent injury, but he could practice corporal punishment for her just the same as he could for his children. And it gets even more extreme when you look overseas. And that when we think of feminism, we often think of, oh, well, you know, only the United States. But a lot of the really good things feminists have done have been overseas, where the discrimination and violence that women face is incredible. I mean, you look over in Pakistan, you have Malala Yousafzai, who just, you know, was 12 years old and was saying girls should be able to go to school. And then the Taliban shot her in the head. And she woke up in a hospital in England, and she's continued to fight for the rights of girls to go to school without getting shot by the Taliban. You've got women that if a woman commits adultery, or even if she's a victim of rape, in many countries overseas, she can be killed with honor killings. Now, a precursor to that is in the 19th century in India, widows were often thrown on funeral pyres with their husbands. It's called sati. So situations where women have faced violence, even because of the inequality in society under the law, it's good that feminism redressed that. Even today, work that is done, there are countries in the Middle East where women can't have driver's licenses. They can't leave the home without a male escort. That's a serious problem, and it's good for feminists to overcome it. That's why it's funny to me. So one of the bad things with feminism, a lot of modern feminism, is this weird intersectionality where you will get feminists who will rail against what's happening in the United States. Like, oh, I can't believe you would outlaw abortion. We're halfway to Gilead. Gilead is the dopey story in the dystopian novel by Margaret Atwood called The Handmaid's Tale. And that's about these patriarchal misogynists taking over the country, outlawing abortion, and doing all these awful, absurd things to women. It's a dopey dystopian novel, though I shouldn't knock it because I'm working on my own dystopian novel right now. Maybe I'll share that with you in a future episode. But the intersectionality thing that happens is that feminists will criticize things here, but they won't criticize clear cases in other countries, especially in countries ruled by Muslim theocracies, where women are being murdered or women have really no freedoms at all because they don't want to be accused of being racist. So that's, and I would love to talk about this stuff. It's so interesting, but we weren't able to get into that. Here's another example. Laws making it illegal to engage in sexual harassment and domestic violence, and especially marital rape. The law used to have an exception that a man could not be held responsible for raping his wife. Marital rape did not become illegal in all 50 states until 1993. So, I mean, what happened in the conversation, you know, I would bring these points up and Tim said, well, no one's debating that stuff now. I said, well, yeah, right, because they had the debates before and feminists had to fight against these things. And now their arguments have reached to the public consciousness where we don't debate this stuff anymore. And so that's a good thing. We don't debate whether women should be able to vote or they should be free from sexual harassment, other things like that. But even some of this stuff is not ancient history. Like it was, like I said, 1993 was finally when marital rape was outlawed. The first man to be put on trial for raping his wife when the two of them lived together in the same home was John Rideout, and that was in Oregon in 1978, and he was actually found not guilty. If you want to watch the story about John, I think it's Rideout or Redoubt, you can look on YouTube. They actually have, in 1980, they did a made-for-TV movie about the case starring Mickey Rourke and Linda Hamilton. And so I kind of laughed a little because it has that cheesy made-for-TV quality. But, I mean, it's scary. It's based on a real event. Like, you know, they were living together and they were in an abusive situation. And Redoubt, you know, knocked, you know, his wife's, gave her a big, the police say, he gave you quite a shiner. We can charge him for assault, but, you know, not for rape because a husband can't rape his wife. And there's a scene where she's running away from him through a park and there's a bunch of people there and she can't even think to go to them to ask for help. And he's running and you see Linda Hamilton running through the park. Someone's after her. And I'm like, oh, no, is it the Terminator? Because she's Sarah Connor in the Terminator movies. But nope, it's her abusive rapist husband. And so Redoubt was found not guilty of rape in a trial in 1978. You might say, well, maybe, you know, maybe he really wasn't guilty. You know, I doubt that because in 2017, Redoubt was found guilty of two charges of rape stemming from incidents in 2013, and he was given 16 years in prison. So not a great guy. In fact, the first domestic violence shelters that opened in the United States weren't until 1973. That's really recent given that domestic violence is a problem that's been around for a long time. But like I said before, what we today would call domestic violence, people in the past called the law of chastisement and say, well, that's just a husband disciplining his wife. That's his rule. But we've seen that, no, that's not the way men and women ought to treat one another. Even in the case of marital rape, in the Rideout case, the prosecutor argued, he said one line, which I thought was creepy. He said, well, that's just the risk of being married. It's what he said to say that you couldn't charge a man with raping his wife. That's, you know, that's just when women get married, that's a risk they take. So we've come a long way. But also, I would have enjoyed talking more about the bad things, because I'm not saying that feminism is universally good or I agree with everything modern feminists do. I disagree with most things they do, even in cases when it comes to arguing that more mothers should work. I definitely agree. And that was the big heated contention we had between us, was over the question of whether mothers should work. And I would agree with him that when Betty Friedan called marriage, Betty Friedan was a second wave feminist, she said that marriage was a comfortable concentration camp. That's stupid. And it's insensitive to, and it was, she said that not too long after the Holocaust, which is a really horrifying and offensive thing to say, and is degrading towards women who love being at home, who love being at home and raising their children. So I think that many feminists who degrade mothers who work, who choose to remain at home and work at home raising their children, I can't stand that. And I can't stand when people say things, oh, you just work at home. Oh, you're just at home. Look, my wife doesn't just sit at home eating bonbons on the couch. Does anyone eat bonbons anymore? You know, we always say that the wife's just at home sitting on the couch eating bonbons. No, especially with little kids at home. She's got a lot of things to chase after them to take care of. She's also involved in homeschooling. But you can start there. But then we have to ask really tough questions like, okay, well, mothers serve their families at home, but what about when the kids go to school? What about when they get older? What about when you don't have children? I mean, at one point in the conversation, Tim said that the church taught that wives shouldn't even work, even if they don't have children at home. Because when I was listening to, I think Father Ripperger was making a more natural law argument on this, saying that mothers need to be at home. Women need to be. He only said mothers need to be at home because it's required that the children need that so they're properly morally developed. Well, by that argument, if you think that mothers must be at home during a child's toddler years because they require the moral formation only she can give them, then that same logic entails that she would have to homeschool them, that it would be a sin for her to not homeschool her children. Because I would say you get more moral formation from the ages of 5 to 12 when you're in your elementary years than you do from the ages of, from newborn to 5. But I think a lot of women would say, well, if I don't have any children at home and I just stayed at home, what am I supposed to do all day? Like, this isn't the 19th century. You can clean a house or an apartment if that's where you're living to start off marriage pretty quickly. Then what am I supposed to do? Just clean it in an hour and a half and then sit and twiddle my thumbs until my husband comes home? We have to do things to see what is in the best interests of women, children, and husbands, of the whole family. So I agree there are many cases where both parents work and it's not good for kids. I don't think it's always a good thing. I just don't think it's always a bad thing. I want to avoid those two extremes of saying it's always sinful or it's always not sinful. A good book on showing the costs of when both parents work is Home Alone America, The Hidden Toll of Daycare, Behavioral Drugs, and Other Parent Substitutes by Mary Eberstadt. Mary Eberstadt, Home Alone America. It's good at talking about these things, and we need to talk about that. But we need to avoid the extremes that come up in these conversations and say, what's the most prudential way forward when we're trying to answer these questions? And so the problem that I have and what I wanted to get to in the discussion was the question of whether it is sinful for mothers to work outside the home. Tim even makes an exception in cases of necessity, saying that, well, if both parents have to work or you can't pay your rent or your food, things like that, then he would see that it's okay. Though some people, I think, would say that the man should work two or three jobs if that is the case, and the wife should stay at home, which I think is a terrible bit of advice. You're saying that it would be better for kids to never see their father, if he's working two or three jobs, than to trade off and have quality time with their father and with their mother in a more balanced atmosphere. That just doesn't make sense to me. So we can, like I said, we can debate, though, the merits of mothers working, when it's good, when it's not. But what I am concerned about is people like Tim and others within that particular community who assert that the church teaches that it is sinful for mothers to work outside the home when it's not in a case of dire economic necessity. Because when you say the church teaches something when it doesn't, you lay a heavy burden on those people. It's bad for people who are scrupulous. And I will say, look, if you're a working mother who's scrupulous about this, if you have discerned in your conscience that this is something that is good for your family, it's not leading to the neglect of your family, and you've discerned that, then you're not committing a sin. You're not committing a sin if you are not neglecting your family and your familial duties by working, if everything's being well taken care of. And I'd also recommend that on Monday, I'm going to share an interview with Joanna Wallen, because I wanted to invite a woman on the podcast. Because I think if we're talking about feminism and women, it's weird if it's just two guys going on and on about that. I think we should hear a woman's perspective. So if you want to hear more about a Catholic woman's perspective on working mothers, you can listen to my interview with Joanna Wallen on Monday, where we talk about that. But that's because Tim said, well, you know, you're saying, why are you so focused on if it's a sin? I said, well, that's the crux issue. Is that what you're saying? And that's what he was claiming by going to these magisterial documents, by going to these documents claiming that they teach that it is a sin. Not just, I'll admit that the documents say that it's good for mothers to be at home and that is an ideal for them, but none of them anywhere ever said, not one that he cited, stated that it is a sin for mothers to work outside of the home. Not one of them. And that's important because now we're looking at the question of how do we interpret these magisterial documents, especially these papal encyclicals, and how do we understand them? Because really the thing that I think we disagreed about was not so much working mothers. We were approaching it with two different frameworks, two different hermeneutics. How do we read these documents of the church? And I think it's clear in my conversation that Tim was misreading these documents in order to make his particular points. And I'll give you a few examples. First, he was confusing exhortations, or what is called hortatory language, with explicit commands of behavior that are sinful if they're disobeyed. So different magisterial teachings will have things like prudential judgments or exhortations saying, do this, we should do that. Pope St. John Paul II said the state shall limit itself to bloodless means when it comes to the case of the death penalty and resolving how to incarcerate prisoners, which Tim sees as that's a prudential judgment, even though it says the state shall do this. So there can be not everything that we see in a magisterial document is an enunciation of doctrine. Usually when you see doctrine, there's a reference to a phrase or something that denotes that the church teaches this. But we don't see that here. Instead, we get statements that talk about truths like children need their mothers, which is correct. A mother shouldn't be completely absent from her children's lives. But those statements about the need that children have for their biological parents, that children are not just accessories to their parents, which sometimes, unfortunately, they're treated that way today, they don't prescribe a specific universal course of action, like saying, all mothers must remain at home at all times, even when their children are at school. Also, especially when we looked at Rerum Novarum and the later encyclicals by Pope Pius XI, Gordon misunderstood papal opposition to women being forced to work in degrading conditions like factories, other things like this, that many of them also said, like Pope Leo XIII talked about how children shouldn't have to be forced to work. But that wouldn't mean that teenagers couldn't go out later and get jobs that are good for them and don't exploit them. You just shouldn't. The point of these encyclicals was that wives and children should not be forced to work, given in this new economy, thinking that they have to do that for survival. And they're usually in very degrading or dangerous working conditions. But I think one of the biggest roadblocks that occurred in our discussion was that Tim didn't acknowledge that there are non-infallible doctrines. And to be fair, a lot of Catholics make this mistake. They think that, oh, well, doctrine can develop, but it can't change. That's not what the church teaches. You'll be hard-pressed to find anywhere where the church teaches that doctrine develops, but it doesn't change. It most certainly does change. They'll say, well, it can't reverse or it can't change course in the other direction. That's not the case at all. So I tried to enunciate that to him, and I was getting interrupted, that he seemed to think that doctrine, you know, there are disciplines that change, that's true, but that there are doctrines and he recognized there are infallible doctrines But he didn't seem to recognize that there are non-infallible doctrinal teachings of the church that do change, and even change in a course that we would call a reversal, not just, well, a development or a greater unfolding, but they recognize more of a reversal of teaching. I'll give you two examples. First, limbo. So limbo was considered at one point, the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith in 2007 released a document on the hope of salvation for infants who are not baptized. And it says the notion that infants who die without baptism are deprived of the beatific vision. So limbo was like this pleasant kind of nursery unbaptized babies went to. They didn't go to hell because they hadn't sinned, but they couldn't be with God because they didn't have grace. So the document says, which has for this place, limbo or this state, for so long it had been regarded as the common doctrine of the church. This is not just mere theological speculation. I mean, a lot of fathers and popes held to the view of limbo. A lot of people held to limbo. So many did that it was considered the common doctrine of the church that unbaptized infants did not go to heaven. They went to limbo instead. It was not an infallible teaching. It was not held to be definitive that people had to believe in limbo in the same way that you had to believe in heaven or hell. Those are infallible teachings. You've got to believe in heaven and you've got to believe in hell to be Catholic. You deny those, you're in a state of heresy. But limbo itself never reached that status. It was never infallibly defined, but it was a common doctrine of the church. It was something that was taught. It was taught very widely. But then this 2007 document from the CDF says, this gave rise to numerous pastoral problems, so much so that many pastors of souls have asked for a deeper reflection on the ways of salvation. And so the development of limbo, what's happened with that doctrine is that it's no longer the common doctrine of the church. Rather, now it is a part of theological speculations. You're allowed to speculate and consider the possibility that unbaptized infants do not receive the beatific vision, but the more common teaching today is that we have hope in God who is merciful, who can give grace to anyone who chooses, and who is not, who binds salvation to the sacraments, but he himself is not bound to them, paragraph 1257 of the Catechism. And so we have hope in him and a merciful Father that even those children who die without baptism can still have a possibility of eternal life with him. The other example that I gave was tonsure. Tonsure was the practice, and this is hard. We were going back and forth so quick, we couldn't even sit down and talk about this because it's important. This is not a random esoteric part of church history. Tonsure is the practice of shaving the head as part of a religious vow. So in the church, well, there were three kinds of tonsure. A third one that was banned by the hierarchy. We don't know much about it because it was suppressed. The other two were the Pauline tonsure in the Eastern Church, which is where you shave the whole head to be bald. And the other is the Petrine tonsure, which is like the corona or the crown. And it's where you shave. It's when you think of tonsure and like monks, there was even a video on Vox, which is a secular website talking about tonsure, that when you look in medieval paintings, you see that religious, they always have this same haircut, that they have a haircut that leaves a crown at the top. They have hair on their sides and kind of it's like the inverted bowl cut, basically. So they cut a circle on the top of their head and leave the hair all around the sides. And this was a teaching. So Tim was right. He said, well, that's a discipline. No, there is a discipline that religious had to shave their heads. And in fact, that there were serious disagreements in the 7th century in the church between religious in Ireland and the British Isles who did not practice tonsure and those in continental Europe that did. And those in the British Isles, they said, no, you have to do this. This is a discipline of the church. And you're right. Discipline can change. But here's the thing. This discipline, why do religious have to shave their heads in this way? Well, the church had taught for a very long time that tonsure comes from apostolic tradition. In fact, the Roman Catechism that we were debating in our discussion, it says this form of the tonsure, the church teaches to be derived from apostolic tradition. So here we have very clear with a formula. This is not a discipline. This is not a prudential judgment. The Catechism is saying the church teaches this comes from the apostles. So that is why there is a discipline. And so people have to shave their heads because this is a teaching we receive from the apostles. But it was not an infallible teaching. It was not proposed definitively. And now no one holds that view. So it wasn't just the Roman Catechism. The Catechism was summarizing a very common view people had about this tradition believed to have come from the apostles and being the foundation for the tonsure discipline. But in the 20th century, even the Catholic Encyclopedia, like 1908, said that nobody believes tonsure came from the apostles. It probably arose in monasteries around the 5th or 6th century. And because of this, because we saw the church came to realize, well, this is not an apostolic tradition that needs to be binding or continuing on, Pope Paul VI changed the discipline. In fact, this actually made the New York Times in 1972. There was an article in the New York Times that said Pope Paul VI ordered the abolition of the tonsure, the circular shaving of the crown of the head that was that marked preliminary steps on the way to priesthood. So this is a big deal to me that if people say, this is what worries me, when people say, oh, well, the church doesn't change, it only develops, it would never reverse a teaching. If we misunderstand that and put it too simply, then when people go to college and they read the works of theologians, including more liberal or dissident theologians, where they do point out areas where non-infallible teaching was reversed, not just, you know, a greater unfolding, but it was reversed, then someone might think, wait, I thought the church couldn't change its teachings like this. It can? Well, I guess the church isn't really filled with the Holy Spirit. Christ didn't establish it, and it can cause a crisis for faith in people, much the same way that teachings saying that, oh, you have to believe the earth was created 6,000 years ago, which some Catholics say that you have to believe that. It's a small minority, but some do. Well, that can create a crisis of faith if you go to a university and see science clearly shows that the earth was created, that the earth formed 4.54 billion years ago and the universe was created 13.7 billion years ago. So because non-infallible teachings can change over time, including those, then I would say that the teachings we discussed about women staying at home never articulated a formula saying the church teaches this or the church says that one ought to do this. They were prudential judgments or hortatory statements. But because non-infallible teaching can change in this way, that means you can't say the church what the church teaches. You can't use a hermeneutic where you just multiply tons of quotations from historical documents. You have to say, okay, well, what has the church taught? And has that developed and has it changed now at this point? Because you can go back, and this the examples I gave in the dialogue that are still valid, was that for a long time, the church taught that certain passages of the Bible taught that the earth is at the center of the universe. Now that is, you know, Tim said, well, no, it's only faith and morals. Right. The question of where the earth is in relation to the sun is a scientific question, but a question of what the Bible means, that's a question of faith and morals. And the church taught, not in a definitive way, but it traditionally taught that some passages in scripture imply or teach that the earth is at the center of the universe. You know, Joshua bade the sun to stand still, for example. I go on about that in my book, Hard Sayings, if you want more on that. But then new developments in astronomy caused the church to reconsider these non-infallible, non-definitive interpretations of the Bible. Much the same way that developments in economic thought caused the church to reconsider the question of whether all interest-bearing loans count as usury. Because I'll give you one. If looking at the magisterial documents Tim cited shows that, here's these documents, it's very clear, mothers can't work outside the home, then you look at other documents in church history, it's very clear you can't charge interest on a loan. Now, some people try to get around this to say, well, the church only condemned excessive interest when it condemned usury. That's not the case. In fact, I remember reading Taylor Marshall talked about this on his blog once, saying, oh, the Council of Nicaea only condemned taking excessive interest. No, the Council of Nicaea in Canon 17 gives an example of interest that clerics charged on loans because oftentimes the priests had money. They had money and resources and they could lend to people. But the council never said you can lend at this acceptable rate of interest. It said you can't lend at interest at all. And then later councils said lay people couldn't lend at interest. As late as 1745, in Vix per Venit, Pope Benedict XIV said that the sin of usury comes about by any gain which exceeds the amount in the original loan. And he said, it can't be argued that one cannot condone the sin of usury, lending at interest, by arguing that the gain is not great or excessive, but rather that it's moderate or small. Neither can it be condoned by arguing that the borrower is rich or that he's using it, it's not left idle, but that it's spent usefully. He goes on, he's very clear in there that there was a long teaching in church history that taking any interest on a loan was immoral. It was a form of theft. It was called usury. But then there was a change in the teaching. There was a change in the teaching. In 1822 and 1830, the Holy See gave advice to confessors and said that you should leave undisturbed those who engage in the practice of lending at interest. So what has changed in the teachings? There was a change in one teaching, that it's wrong to lend at interest. That teaching has changed. But the broader teaching, that you should not lend money in a way that exploits the poor, or you should not give out a loan, you should not contract a loan to which you don't have a just title, that did not change. But as economics developed, the church changed in its understanding of what a just loan was, or what a just title of a loan was. So today the church still, in the Catechism and Second Vatican Council, condemns usury, but shows that there are cases where lending at interest is justly connected to a loan. And so it would be more excessive interest that would be sinful. So to continue the analogy, the church could teach that mothers ought to remain at home because otherwise, if they're not there, their families would be neglected. But as we grow in our understanding of what constitutes the neglect of the family, what constitutes having a stable household, people can see, oh, well, as conditions have changed, mothers can work, and they can work in various contexts to not to the detriment of their family life. And that is why the hermeneutic Tim employed is a bad one, because it focuses on these older teachings, but doesn't show what the magisterium teaches now and the development that's occurred. Otherwise, you could take the same hermeneutic, and like I said in the dialogue, you would believe that all loans are evil and that the earth is at the center of the universe. We have to see what has the church taught, but has that developed, and what does the church teach now? And I thought that he really just kind of hand-waved away what the magisterium teaches now. Which it's very clear what it does teach, that it's not inherently sinful for mothers to work outside the home, even in cases when it's not economically necessary. So in Pacem in Terris, Tim said, well, it's talking about women working at home. No, it's not. In Pacem in Terris, Pope John the 23rd says in paragraphs 18 and 19, in the economic sphere, he talks about it's evident that a man has the right to given the opportunity to work, but be allowed the exercise of personal initiative in the work he does, and that the conditions in which a man works form a necessary corollary to these rights, so they shouldn't weaken his physical or moral fiber. But then it says, women, in this same section on work in the economic sphere, women must be accorded such conditions of work as are consistent with their needs and responsibilities as wives and mothers. So here, according conditions of work, he's not talking about conditions of work in the home. He's saying conditions of work outside the home that don't conflict with a mother's primary responsibility to be a wife and a mother. Much the same in 2004, the CDF, you know, the highest teaching office in the church, in its document, Collaboration of Men and Women in the World, Tim really just hand-waved this away, but here's a clear magisterial teaching saying that women who freely desire will be able to devote the totality of their time to the work of the household without being stigmatized by society or penalized financially, i.e. women should be able to stay home and not be stigmatized or penalized, while those who wish also to engage in other work may be able to do so with an appropriate work schedule and not have to choose between relinquishing their family life or enduring continual stress. So if it was a sin for mothers to work outside the home, the CDF would have just told us that. But no, it says women can work outside the home, provided they have an appropriate work-life balance. So if you don't take that into account, then you get stuck and you don't allow doctrine to develop. You read things like the Roman Catechism and you take it hyper rigidly when it says the wife should love to remain at home unless compelled by necessity to go out, and she should never presume to leave home without her husband's consent. So this is clearly a prudential judgment about how households should be arranged and how they should live in the 16th century. Even if it were a doctrine, it's clearly developed because nobody teaches now that a wife always needs her husband's consent to leave the home. I mean, does she always have to call to get permission to go to the store? I mean, Tim said I was making fun of it, but I'm not. That's what the language here says. She should never presume to leave home without her husband's consent. Does that mean that, well he said it was dispositive, that maybe the husband could give a blanket permission. Well, if that's the case, then I would agree that a woman shouldn't get a job without her husband's consent, just like the husband shouldn't take a new job without his wife being involved in the decision. But if that's the case, if it's dispositive, then women, mothers can work outside the home. if the father thinks that there's nothing wrong with that. Otherwise, if you read it the way that it's written, it seems like the mother can never go to the store without her husband's consent. Or what if the mom, the wife, wants to visit her relatives for a weekend and leave the kids with the father over the weekend? Should she be allowed to do that? Well, it seems like it's not necessity. She just misses her parents and she'd like to visit them for a weekend and not take the whole family along with. It would seem to be a sin for her to do that, but the church clearly doesn't teach these things. Because you can look at it this way. If it really were a sin for mothers to work outside the home, why doesn't the catechism, the universal catechism now, say so? Why doesn't it say it's a sin now? Now, you might say, well, because it's so popular because of feminism, the spineless authors of the catechism can't go against popular culture because it's gotten so popular, they can't come right out and say that it's sinful. That argument doesn't work because from the 1960s onwards, what else got popular? Abortion, contraception, homosexuality, divorce. All those four things were incredibly popular, and they still are, right? But did the spineless authors of the catechism just ignore them? No, they came out and reaffirmed the church's continual teaching and clearly denounced those things. So if a mother's working from home is sinful, like these things are sinful, even if it's popular, they would have said the same thing. But they didn't, because that's not what the church teaches. There can be cases where mothers and fathers work to the neglect of their family, and that is what is sinful. But the church does not teach that mothers just have to remain at home. And I think it was very instructive the church doesn't teach that, because Tim didn't really have an answer when I brought up the case of St. Gianamola. St. Gianamola did not work out of necessity. She was a physician, her husband was an engineer, she had several children, and she continued to work as a physician. And, you know, she ended up being canonized because of her life of holiness and because she chose to not abort her child to save her own life. So that's a part of it. You might say, well, she was only canonized because of her heroic act of saving her child's life at the end of her life. Well, no, because lots of people can do heroic things, but if they've lived lives of manifest public sin in disobedience to what the church teaches, then they're not fit for canonization. It would be the same as someone who is heroic at the end of their life, but lived a life of notorious adultery or was an abortionist or something like that and never repented or gave that up. So the fact that St. Gianamola was canonized and she was a working mother, I think is very strong evidence the church does not consider being a working mother, even in a case that's not of economic necessity, to be something that's sinful. Finally, I want to end with an article I saw by Cary Gress, who's actually written a book about feminism from a Catholic perspective. And she points out in the Anti-Mary Exposed, Rescuing the Culture from Toxic Femininity, she points out a lot of things that are wrong with modern feminism. But it was interesting that this article, it showed up actually on October 22nd. So it was posted after the dialogue that I had with Tim. And so I think a lot of people are talking about this question, and that's why she felt compelled to write it. So I'm going to end my debrief by reading from this article, because it wasn't available a week ago, 2 weeks ago, when I had my conversation. So this is what Dr. Cary Gress writes. Women, to work or not to work? Since the 1960s, women have been encouraged to throw off the shackles of home and dive into careers. The regnant wisdom has been that a career is far more satisfying than homemaking. As I've outlined in my book, The Anti-Mary Exposed, 5 decades later, the ramifications of this rush to work are being felt deeply throughout the culture. The absence of women as the heart of the family has led to a sharp decline in personal happiness among men, women, and children, while abuse, neglect, suicide, divorce, consumerism, and narcissism have increased. I fully agree with that. In reaction to this, many Catholics are suggesting an opposing view that women shouldn't do any sort of work outside the home, conjuring up memories of June and Ward Cleaver as the model Catholic family. As Aristotle pointed out over 2 centuries ago, however, the human mind is comfortable oscillating between extremes, but the extremes are generally not the right answer. A closer look at the historical Catholic family looks a lot more like Jean-François Millet's famous mid-19th century painting, The Angelus, which depicts a man and his wife who have been working together in the field, stopping to pray when the church bells ring, or like Saint Zélie and Louis Martin and their at-home lace company that kept the family of Saint Thérèse of Lisieux living comfortably, or like the widowed Saint Elizabeth Ann Seton, who became a teacher to support her 6 young children. In my own family, my father died, leaving my mother with 4 children to care for and raise. Although she had been a stay-at-home mom, she knew how this business worked, so she was able to take it over after his death. What all these examples have in common are how work, survival, and family were cobbled together as best could be done under often challenging circumstances. Even convents point to consecrated women selling products outside the convent to live sustainably. Truly, these religious balance, ora et labora, prayer and work. Significant familial changes took place when industrialization first took husbands from the home. Industrialization also mechanized the basic skills that women used to find deep satisfaction in: gardening, sewing, canning, knitting, cooking, and so on. Lost to women were the kinds of work that philosopher Alistair MacIntyre calls practices. Practices are real crafts producing real products, but they had the added bonus of edifying the one practicing the craft. Practices aren't just rote, mundane tasks such as sorting darks and lights, but real skills such as St. Zell's lace, which often helped the family finances. Today's rote activities, minus the practices of old, coupled with the isolation of stay-at-home moms and cultural stigma against homemaking, leave many women deeply dissatisfied and unsupported. There is no going back to the pre-industrial revolution age, but we can and should think more carefully about the nature of work and what it means to women and families instead of adjudicating with an absolute yes or no. Sociologist W. Bradford Wilcox has shown that the happiest women are those who are at home with their children, but who also have some type of work outside the home, however small. The internet has provided opportunities for women and men to try to break out of the 9-to-5 rut to reduce a homemaker's isolation. One of the downfalls of the last 50 years has been that instead of women demanding that their work be family-friendly, they have adjusted their families to the work. The internet is changing that with new opportunities for work with shorter or more flexible hours than were previously available. When considering women's work, the whole household must be brought into the focus and a broader look at what Catholic womanhood looks like. We must ask how we help women use their remarkable gifts to serve both their families and the greater good, instead of choosing one or the other. There will not be a one-size-fits-all answer for every family, but looking at how to serve the needs of the entire family will serve everyone better than simply grasping at extremes. So I think it's a wonderful point to end on. And finally, to end on, I want to thank Tim once again for coming down. I mean, we probably do agree on like 95% of things. We just passionately disagree about this. But I'm glad we were at least able to talk. And I hope that this is a stepping stone towards more conversations, real conversations we can have with each other. And not just, oh, we're going to talk back and forth on Twitter or Facebook. That's not super productive. I would love to see more, because the church is really divided right now about the Francis Pontificate, what's going on in the Synod. There's a lot of division and anger and tension. I want to see more of us sitting down. I think this conversation could have been a lot better, and I hope it at least paves the way for us to have more conversations that are more fruitful, and we can really talk about where we disagree and how we can move forward as a church, as brothers and sisters, as part of the one church, to move forward so we can evangelize people and lead lost souls to Jesus Christ. That's what we need to be doing. We need each other to do that. The church is a body with many parts. We can't say there's one part of the body that doesn't belong. St. Paul says you can't do that. We all got to work together on this, and I'm glad and hope that we will be able to. So I hope that these dialogues were edifying in at least some way for you, and we can continue to have these discussions about disagreements we have and do so in a productive way. So thank you guys so much, and I hope you all have a really blessed day and enjoy our other dialogues. Thanks.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.